Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is the founder of Modern Musician, Michael Walker. First of all, Tennessee has adopted the Ensuring Likeness, Voice, and Image Security, or the Elvis Act, that will officially go into effect in the state on July 1st, 2024. This is a bipartisan law, and it's intended to protect artists' voices from misuse of artificial intelligence, or AI. The Elvis Act is described as the first legislation of its kind in the United States that builds on existing state rules protecting the unauthorized use of someone's likeness. Till now, this was name and image, popularly known as NIL, but now it also includes voice as well. This is intended to preserve the authenticity of the music that we listen to and is already supported by just about every association that represents musicians and songwriters. The law does allow situations where the unauthorized use of someone's voice is permitted, like in connection with any news, public affairs, or sports broadcasts, as well as instances of comment, criticism, scholarship, satire, or parody. In other words, fair use. One of the flaws of the Elvis Act is that it might be too broad and might affect performers like Elvis impersonators and tribute bands. Then there are the concerns about the potential unintended consequences that could impact the creativity of artists down the road. The U.S. House of Representatives lawmakers are also currently working on their version of the Elvis Act, and this is called the No Artificial Intelligence, Fake Replicas, and Unauthorized Duplications Act, or the No AI Fraud Act. Boy, it's a mouthful. And it's trying to do the same thing as the Elvis Act on a federal level while maintaining First Amendment free speech protections. It's going to be a lot tougher sell because of pushback from the powerful film and TV lobbies, though. That said, the Elvis Act is a big step forward to protecting artists and songwriters in the future. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that my new Musicians AI Handbook is now available. It's packed with information about how AI can help you with new song, lyric, mixing, and mastering ideas, as well as music marketing to help you get your music out to the audience that you deserve. To get your copy, go to bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. That's bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. Music Radar named its best digital audio workstations for 2024, and the list is pretty interesting. Coming in at number one is Ableton Live, and they say this is the best DAW for electronic music. I don't think they're wrong there. It's pretty good for that. Number two is FL Studio, which they claim is the best for making beats. Number three is Apple Logic Pro, which they say is the best for Mac, and I don't think they're wrong. It's a really great program. Number four is Steinberg Cubase, and they claim it's the best pedigree, which means it's the oldest, I guess, and that's true. Yet, it still works today. Number five, Persona Studio One, say it's the best for guitarists. I don't know about that. It's a pretty strong and sturdy version of Cubase, really, because it's the same designers that broke off from Steinberg and then went over and started their own DAW. So this is like a modern version of Cubase. Number six, Kukos Reaper, and they claim it's the best value, and that's for sure. You get a very powerful DAW at a really bargain price. Number seven is Reason Studio's Reason, which they say is the best second DAW. I don't know if I agree with that. I don't agree with the ranking, and I'm not so sure it's the best for a second DAW. The best second DAW I always thought would be the best for creation that isn't necessarily your best DAW for mixing, for instance. Number eight is Bitwig Studio. They say it's best for experimentation. Again, not so sure about that one. Number nine is Apple GarageBand. Best for Mac beginners. Yep, certainly right about that. And number 10 is Avid Pro Tools. They claim it's the best for post-production, and they're certainly right there because it's the standard in post-production, and there's really not a close second when it comes to post. Number 11 is Traction Waveform Free, which they say is the best free DAW. That may be true, but on the other hand, GarageBand is now available for PC as well, so that might be the best free one. So whatever you choose, your DAW of choice is still dependent upon the audio job that you're trying to do. If you're just a hobbyist, then anything that you're comfortable with will probably work for you. But as soon as you hit the pro level, you're pretty much confined to what other pros are using. So choose your digital audio workstation carefully. My guest this week is Michael Walker, who's the founder and energy behind the Modern Musician Program. You can hear all about his journey on episode 411 from March 2022, but this time our discussion centered around AI and how it can help or hurt the music industry in the future. Modern Musician recently incorporated its own AI-driven helper bot, so Michael has a lot of hands-on experience on the subject. During our interview, we spoke about integrating ChatGPT into Modern Musician, his experiences with Apple's new Vision Pro, how spatial music and spatial picture so closely go together, how sometimes AI image generation is creating more of what a dream might look like, what future AI technology might hold for us, and much more. I spoke with Michael from a studio in Florida. You jumped into AI early and integrated into Modern Musician. What brought that on? What did you feel you're going to accomplish by having an AI involved?
Yeah, I mean, it was probably born out of just my personal admiration and appreciation of the first AI tool that I used extensively, which was ChatGPT when it first came out. I must have stumbled upon it, luckily, like a day after it first came out. But I remember when it first came out and starting to use this tool, and my mind was just blown by how fast it was, how good it was at generating. What now, like looking back, we're like, oh, like it probably wasn't even that good. Like it was kind of, you're looking at it, we're like, oh, that's like clearly an AI. It's like not that good. But at the time I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And I remember, I think it was like New Year's, the same year that ChatGPT came out, I was like sitting at a bar with some friends, and we were goofing off playing around with ChatGPT, and I was like blowing their minds by using it and coming up with, I think we came up with like a business strategy or a product strategy for something ridiculous. I remember it was called Space Water. We're like, space water, like the best, like the product of the world, but it's basically just water. But like, yeah. We call it space water.
I like the name. Right off, you got me in.
We could go somewhere with that. Yes, yeah. It's special. It was from carved from outer space. That's what we did. We were like, you describe an ad for space water, and it was like, you're from the, from comets, like Jupiter's moons. And I don't know. It was much. Yeah, it was fantastic. It was amazing. And so pretty quickly, when I started playing around with it, my mind was blown just by like it as a tool. And I started to see just the value of like using it in my own life and using it to brainstorm ideas and brainstorm emails. And in the past year in particular, I mean, it's been a huge breakthrough in terms of the rate of progress and growth with AI, with the image generation and now video generation coming out. And I think for me, like, what inspired me to start building it as a tool was that, similar to, I think, the internet, when the internet first came out, there's a huge opportunity where there's a breakthrough technology. It's also kind of scary in some ways and not fully understood in a lot of ways. And this is a technology that, from my perspective, is you're going to completely change the world, probably on the same level as the internet, maybe more, probably more. In some ways, like, this is an extension of the internet and that breakthrough. It's not like a separate thing. So the way I look at it was just that I think this tool is one of the most revolutionary tools that exists right now. And I think that it's also going to, like, every industry is going to have a breakthrough related to AI and as a service, the same way that the internet, it can basically be applied to almost every industry. And so because I personally am so inspired and just geek out about it, and the tools are built in a way, in particular OpenAI, like part of their main business model is building their API to let other developers build tools on top of it. So the opportunity that I saw for it is the same opportunity I see for every industry, which is having a fine-tuned version of like an AI assistant that, you know, has some better context for your goals and what you're trying to achieve and is able to, you know, kind of just shortcut the distance between your idea, your intention, and the actual thing.
Yeah, you know, to be honest with you, I'm a little frustrated with it. As a writer, I keep on hoping it's going to do something as good as I do. And I've trained it on my material and my voice, and it never gets there. Now, what it does do, it gives me some really good ideas. And sometimes if I'm doing like ads, Facebook ads, I'll write the first one and I'll say, give me, you know, four variations, and it will do a good job on that. But I get frustrated. Now, let's talk about something that applied to that. This morning, I read an article on Medium, and it was from a writer who said, one of the typical things that people are taught when it comes to prompting is to give ChatGPT a persona and say, you've been writing for 20 years, you're an expert at this, assume you're this. Mm. And this person said, look, this is the wrong way to go about it, and here's why. So he goes and he gives it a really simple prompt. And what it was write an ad, a registration for Ryanair, and two sentences. And it came back with something beautiful, but with a very simple prompt. And then he said, okay, so assume you're a writer. And it came back with something, you know, with five sentences and a lot of extravagant wording that it didn't really need. And then he kept on doing that, giving it different personas, and it kept on coming back with things that were not as good as the very first one with the simple prompt.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I've always gone from the prompting that I've been taught, which is give it a persona and it does give you something better, but maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, that's super interesting. And I think it brings up a good point, which is that, you know, this is a tool where, like any relationship, like with another human being or a team member, like our ability to communicate with the tool and to be able to express and be understood is a really, really important part of getting the value from it. And yeah, I think it's definitely possible to over prompt engineer, you know, ChatGPT, and to in a lot of cases, yeah, it's like, it's sort of like the law of attraction where it's like, you know, don't run into this pole. And it's like, we end up like turning right into the pole.
Yeah.
So there is an art to it. And I think it's like most things, it's an acquired skill. And if you just like are in the field using it and playing around with it and figuring out what works and what doesn't, then there are nuanced cases where in some cases, the more extravagant prompt might do better if it's, you know, if it's getting it wrong without the extra context. But in some cases, you know, starting out with a super simple, you know, no context kind of prompt, it could get it. I do think that longer term, there's going to be more and more like personalization of like, we'll have a better trained AI based on our own data that is able to predict with more accuracy what we want and what we're intending it to do. Like right now, there's some signal misses because it's not always going to get perfect our intention. Like we might, like I want, you know, XYZ, but it doesn't understand it because we either haven't communicated the right way or just doesn't get it yet. But I think that there is a path. Yeah, I think we're pretty early on. But I think that with more time and more data, and particularly with, you know, like trained data based on our own identity, that it's going to get closer and closer to being able to match our voice and our intention.
I was talking to somebody who is very intimate with Apple, and so much so that he saw the Apple car, the actual prototype of the Apple car.
Before it got canceled?
Yeah, before it got canceled. And he says, watch out for Apple's AI when it comes out. And the reason why, it's going to be what you just said, or at least the rumor is it's going to be what you said, where it's going to be very individual and it's going to be local. And that's why, you know, all the new Macs have their own neural engines that are built in. So, you know, he intimated that it should be pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. I mean, I think that Apple, they seem like they're one of the most well-positioned brands to fully utilize an AI service like that. And in my opinion, too, like the bio wearable industry and things like a neural interface with our brains, if we had to trust a company to have like a brain chip or an interface with our thoughts, like what brand would we trust with that right now? I mean, most people I think would be like, I wouldn't trust anybody with a brain chip. But if we had to choose like a brand, I certainly wouldn't choose Meta or like Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
Not that I'm a fan of Meta in some ways, but I wouldn't trust them with like a chip in my brain. And I think that Apple, at least, you know, in part, their long-term strategy seems to be really focusing in on privacy and building trust and brand trust, because that's going to be the best, you know, position brand to be able to do more things like what they're doing with Apple Watches and more wearables, and certainly with their spatial audio, spatial computing with the Vision Pro. Really, really interesting to think where they're going to go in the future with that.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned Vision Pro, because I know you had one. I don't know if you still have it, but you did have one. The last time we talked was maybe a month ago. Tell me what your experiences are over time.
Yeah, the Vision Pro. So I've never been like a huge VR guy, but I've played around with each of the headsets. Like I have a Quest 3 and I've played around with it. I've played Super Hot. I've played some of the Keystone games for it. And with every device up until that Apple Vision Pro, it was really cool. At the beginning, especially, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is crazy. I can go in slow-mo and there's bullets flying at me. But then it sort of lost its appeal a bit, and it's mostly kind of collected dust on my shelf. The Apple Vision Pro definitely feels like it's in its own category from a standpoint of it's just like, for a good reason, it's like a much more expensive product. And a different use case. Like in some ways, it's worse than the Quest 3. Like it's not as portable. It's, you know, you have a wire attached to it. But in what they were going for, I think that they created a state-of-the-art, you know, device, which is really, really good at creating the fidelity, like the visual quality of the screens that you're looking at, and the intuitiveness that they created the user interface around. I mean, that you could probably say that that's one of Apple's cornerstone, you know, brand identity, is like their user interfaces and creating simplicity around what we're describing with AI, like around mapping intention to outcome in as simple as way as possible. Like how do we just get rid of all of it and just map intention to outcome? And for the Vision Pro, the way that they do that is through eye tracking. And so you look around and your eyes are like a cursor. So you just look at, you know, the button and you tap your finger and you click it. So that was an experience that felt more intuitive than anything else that I've experienced related to like VR and navigation. So I think it's really interesting. I also think that clearly like this wasn't they're not looking to create a mass adopted device with this. This is like an early adopter gimmicky kind of toy for people who can afford it. It's also a little bit of a status symbol, I feel like, in a way that the Quest didn't feel like. Like I wouldn't have felt cool pulling out my Quest on an airplane like, and pulling up my like VR headset, yeah, like looking around.
Right.
And even like the Vision Pro, like I feel a little bit questionable, like you pulling out this thing on an airplane. But I mean, me personally, I actually felt like it was kind of cool. Like when I pulled out the Vision Pro, like it felt like it raised my social status as opposed to like lowering it. You know, that's a thing that's usually subconscious, but I think it's a pretty powerful thing. And I think it's part of what Apple's, you know, ethos is around like, you know, social status. And, you know, after the plane ride, there's a couple of people that came up after the flight. We're like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Like, you know, it's like, tell me more about it. And so, yeah, I think that's another interesting, you know, thing that Apple has going for it. And I think it's overall a net positive for just the space in general. Like it's bringing more credibility to the space for spatial computing. And I do think that the future, you know, is in spatial computing. It's probably not going to be a bulky headset the way that it is right now. It's probably going to evolve to be like a pair of glasses at next, and then maybe some sort of like retinal scanners that are less, you know, they get in the way of interacting with the world. I still think that in a shorter time frame than we think, we're going to evolve to something more interconnected with our thoughts, like a Neuralink or a brain interface. But I think that there's going to be some this is going to be longer to get there than it is to get to like sunglasses that are mixed with AI and augmented reality.
Did you try to shoot any special videos?
Not a whole lot, but I got a couple of them and they were interesting.
Because to me, that's attractive. If I can actually develop my own content, and it doesn't have to be for any outside consumption, it could just be for me, but I would find that really interesting and attractive.
Yeah, I think it's very cool. I mean, I personally am not utilizing my cell phone to its greatest degree in terms of like taking videos and photos. And so I personally haven't dove super deep into taking videos on it, but the ones that I have were really interesting. And I think that there's something that's really interesting that's going to happen as it relates to like video generation and AI, in that they're already like the new Sora model from OpenAI. You can give it an image or give it a video and then it will like bring it to life. So as an artist, you could have your cover art and then turn it into a video where it's like, it's becoming a music video. In doing so, it's like it's basically becoming a predictive model where it's predicting like what's going to happen. And so I think that what we're going to see is probably similar to how we can actually bring to life black and white photos and things and make them feel like super high quality and real. I bet that some of the spatial videos that we can capture with these devices, and maybe even 2D videos in the future, will be able to turn that experience into like a fully simulated environment where it's like the AI generates this digital environment and we can actually fully experience and relive that experience, not just from like a standpoint of like a normal video, but you could actually enter the simulator and like reimagine that experience and do it differently. See what happens if you behave differently in it.
Now, see, what I find interesting here is I don't think immersive music and immersive audio in general is going to take off until you have spatial picture, because one feeds off the other. And the way it is now, they're disconnected. Disconnected experiences. With immersive music, for instance, I don't see that ever taking off in its current form. And you find that there's nobody out there on the consumer level that's clamoring for it. To me, there's, we have to go a couple levels here, but we could see what those are, which, just 6 months ago, maybe we couldn't.
Yeah, it's super interesting. Yeah, I think you're right. It doesn't seem like there's really been a huge need for spatial, music like there will be when we can actually map it and sync it to visuals in like a digital space. I also think that, I think probably the future of musical experiences will be much more interactive, and it will be, connected to this sort of spatial computing, where I think that the listener will have an opportunity to more directly influence the nature of the music as it's happening. So either there'll be these experiences where you can, walk around the room and like the music will change, and you can play around with little trinkets and things, and it'll change like the instruments that are happening. You can kind of blend it into your own thing. Maybe if we have like a neural device, we could actually generate a soundtrack that perfectly matches your emotional state and is designed to perfectly transform your state from wherever you are to help you process that and like you enter a heightened state of emotion or whatever your desired emotion is. Maybe it would build the song around you and kind of bring you to a different state. But yeah, I do think that that's something that isn't like for today, it's the technology's not there, but it'd be interesting to start building for it, because in the not too near future, in fact, like right now with the Vision Pro, I think there's an opportunity for some really innovative music spaces that you could start doing today.
You know about the ability to mix a live concert. While you're there, you can get different mixes. That's been going on for 3 or 4 years. And I know they had it on the last Elton John tour. Now, it's only available to certain people. And you have to wear headphones, obviously, but if you want, you can just hear Elton by himself.
That's cool. So it's like you have your own personal mixing board and you can like change the levels?
Yeah, well, it's on your phone, but and like all these, there's usually only four or five stems that you can do, but still it's the ability. I've always questioned that people want to do that because I think they just want to listen. Musicians wouldn't go in and want to play with all that stuff and isolate and figure out what is the drummer doing or what is that drum loop, but the average person doesn't care.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that it's probably more from not necessarily like the lack of, I don't know, the lack of value from it, but just from the lack of ability for it. Like the common layperson couldn't, actually create like an instrument or do the things. But if you put like Guitar Hero in front of them and they can they can step into the feeling of being the guitar and it's a little bit easier, more accessible for them, then, it's something that a lot of people, enjoy. But I think you're right that it's not necessarily something that right now, people are probably going to resonate with because it requires them to think in a way that they're not used to thinking, and they're probably not going to make it sound better. Like it's probably going to sound worse, and if anything, than if the one who knows what they're doing does it. But I also think in the future it'll be similar to everything we're describing, like where intention is better matched, it's going to be more intuitive. I mean, we'll probably see more personalization with music in general, where it's like all of us have our own personal soundtrack that was written for our life. And it has, I don't know, the names of our kids and like the names of our family members. And we can write songs that blend our relationship together with our best friend. And it does interesting things that are directly relevant to us based on our personality and who we are.
Let's come back to the AI that you've incorporated into Modern Musician. So what does that do exactly?
So we call it Artist AI, and there's two main functions that we've built for it right now. One is as a general Artist AI assistant. So what that is very similar to ChatGPT. If anyone's used ChatGPT, it's chat-based prompts. You ask it for something, it can reply. And I mean, essentially how it works is it's built on OpenAI's model, right? So they have something called an API that lets you build tools on top of it. And we've fine-tuned it to be specifically designed for musicians who are using it to build a successful music career. So what that means is that it's essentially functions the same way as ChatGPT with a little bit better training. So it's better at doing what you might want to use it for. For example, writing emails for your marketing campaigns for releasing a new song, or for writing a welcome sequence to your new fans that join your community, doing things like split testing copy for a landing page, or writing an ad, generating ideas for a social media content calendar. So some things that you could use ChatGPT for, and we're just trying to make it a little bit more intuitive to use it as a musician without having to do as much prompt engineering. And this year, we're focused on building more with OpenAI Sora when it comes out with the video generation. I think there's some really cool stuff we can do with music video, lyric video generation, bringing your cover art to life so that all you do is upload your single artwork and now you have a music video that's really interesting and it kind of brings it to life.
Have you played with it yet?
I haven't played with Sora yet. Last I had heard that it wasn't available for public use, but hopefully soon.
Yeah. I saw the demo and everything. It was really impressive.
Yeah.
I can't wait to get my hands on it.
Yeah. The announcement was huge. And then they released this that technical report that was really interesting. One of the things I thought was most fascinating about that technical report was when they shared the difference in just having more compute or just having more data and how big of an impact that made in the quality of the video that it generated. And they showed an example of a normal base compute, a dog video, and the dog was this warbled mess of, it didn't even really look like a dog. You're like, what is this fluffy, weird thing? And then they showed a video next to it that had 4x compute. And so it was basically the exact same model, exact same everything, except it just had access to four times more data. And the video actually started to look more like a dog. You're like, oh, that's a dog. And it's a little bit weird. You can just tell it seems a little bit off or it's a little bit artificial. And then they shared the video next to that one with 16x compute. And the video for the dog was just immaculate. It looked like a life it was a dog in a video. And the takeaway was that all they were doing is introducing like more data or more compute, and that they're seeing these emergent properties where the AI is having these breakthroughs where it's learning new languages without being trained on like how the language works, just by adding more data to the overall model.
That should make it really interesting. And one of the ways that I test a text to image generator is I have a standard prompt, and it's basically create a Lake Placid blue Stratocaster on a bed of flames.
Ha.
The same thing always comes up. It's like certain pieces are beautiful, but there'll be four pickups, or suddenly the bridge will bend, or there's always something wrong with the guitar, or instead of three controls, there's six. So it's like, okay, you almost got it, but not quite. And the other one is asking for a band on stage with stage lights on them. And then what's interesting that happens many times is you'll get a guitar player that will have two left hands or eight fingers, or, you know, there's always something like that. So I'm waiting for the day that I can use something without having to worry that's going to happen. And then, because it's more work, you know, after you figure this out and you see it for the first time, then you have to go in, you have to reprompt and, you know, kind of figure this out if you want to go down that road. So that's why Sora is interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, that whole concept is super interesting, just like the decoherence of some of the things and the dreamlike nature of some of the generations. I mean, in particular, the earlier models were like real bad, and there's always like 10 or there's like 13 fingers and just like weird, where some of the newer models are like pretty dang good at getting the right amount of fingers and being realistic, and definitely not perfect. But one thing I think is really interesting is just the nature of dreams as like humans, like what are dreams? Where do they come from? And our thoughts and our imagination, both like sleeping dreams, but also like waking dreams and our imagining things, and the coherence behind which we imagine things and like the actual tangible manifestation of those dreams. And it definitely seems like there's a connection. There's something similar happening with intelligence, in that like when we dream, if you look at your hand, like, it looks kind of warbled, and if you look at writing, it looks kind of warbled. And so I think that there is something to the nature of like the universe or intelligence itself, that it's a dream to, and there's just different levels of, I don't know, solidness or tangibility to those dreams. I think that AI is, it's becoming more and more tangible with the more data, the more intelligence that's like added to it. Yeah, it's pretty interesting how that maps out to our own like human dreams as well, and turning those dreams into reality.
Yeah, that's a real interesting way to look at it that I never thought of, but you're right. How do you want to see AI develop? What do you want to see?
I think that the way I'd like to see it develop, and the way I think it is developing and it has to develop, is the same way that, consciousness or the universe, develops, the way that a tree blossoms, and it creates fruit, in that technology is designed to help the universe express itself. And in humanity, the way that we use technology is as a way to transmute an idea or an intention into an outcome. Every device or every piece of technology that we've created has been about transmuting an intention into an ideal outcome. For example, like airplanes, it used to be that if you had the idea, I want to travel around the world, then it would take a whole lifetime, if ever. And now with airplane technology, you can have this intention, I want to travel around the world. And now in a matter of hours, you can travel around the world. And even things that used to be like totally bonker sounding, talking to, like what we're doing right now,
yeah.
Like we're communicating across the world through a portal on our devices, where I can see across the world and we can talk to each other and see each other in real time. And this was born out of this need or this demand, for connection, for to be able to communicate and translate ideas, you know, back and forth. So I think that, you know, AI is just a function of our thoughts, our creativity, the universal impulse to become, to blossom, and that it's, you know, going to be an agent to help us turn intention into an outcome. And then the question is, like, what are our intentions? You know, what are we intending, you know, to do? And that's probably the most important, you know, question. Yeah, I think that at its root, like, the intention of the universe is to know itself and to blossom and to become. So I see these ultimately as a tool for self-expression and a way for us to be able to create, to be able to be in touch with our most authentic selves as creators, and to be able to imagine worlds and turn those worlds into, you know, real spectacles that we can all experience. There's a game that I used to love playing when I was in middle school called Warcraft. And it wasn't World of Warcraft. This is like OG Warcraft 3. But they had these custom games where people could design their own worlds, their own games, using the blocks, the building blocks that the creators like gave you. And then there's these lobbies where you could join the custom game lobby. And this was the most fun part, because people just like came up with all sorts of wild games. And you could join the lobby. You'd be put into a room with a bunch of strangers that you've never, you know, connected with before. And when I was in middle school, I was just like a little shit. I was like, you know, talking smack to, you know, doing all the things you do on the internet. But the way that it relates to this, there was something really interesting about everyone's able to create their own worlds, and you can step into, you know, this realm or this world that was designed for a specific like function or purpose. And I think that there's going to be a phase that we go through of exploration and creativity where it's like the limits have sort of fallen away in terms of whatever you can imagine, like you can do, and you can create, you know, the environment, a world where, you know, that thing is true. And so maybe we'll have fun. We'll have lobbies where people can basically like, come join my world. Like, you know, let's come hang out here. Like, I created this crazy place where there's no gravity. Like, we can float around in outer space, and it's just come like hang out here, and we can explore our identity and who we are, and, you know, change our avatar and live, you know, different experiences. So I feel like that's where we're headed with these like Neuralink brain interface devices. It's just wild that, I don't know, out of the billions of years that the universe has been around, that we could be having this conversation right now at this point of time, where we could actually potentially experience like the state of not having total creative power versus like having the ability to just manifest on demand, like intention, the thing exists. And so I do wonder sometimes about like the nature of reality, and like, and is there, and there's a lot we don't understand about time, right? But maybe there's like something to the way that time is experienced, that it's like the best time to be experiencing is this time right now, because you can experience what it's like to be a limited, separate, you know, isolated self versus like a creator, hive mind.
You can find out more about Michael and Modern Musician at modern-musician.com. That's modern-musician.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.